Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Yesterday was the anniversary of Gerald Ford becoming president, an office he assumed immediately following the resignation of Richard Nixon. Here's Ford on August 9th, 1974, in the East Room, addressing the public for the first time as president of the United States.
If you have not chosen me by secret ballot, neither have I gained office by any secret promises. I have not campaigned either for the presidency or the vice presidency. I have not subscribed to any partisan platform. I am indebted to no man and only to one woman, my dear wife, as I begin this very difficult job.
Ford would serve only 2 years, losing re-election in 1976 to a man who would go on to become another one-term president, Jimmy Carter. Our most recent one-term president, Donald Trump, might be angling to remove himself from that list by running again in 2024, and there has been much speculation about whether President Joe Biden will only serve one term. Here now to discuss the legacy of 20th century one-term presidents is historian, Princeton University history professor, and author Julian Zelizar. Julian, welcome back.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
Let's talk a little bit about Gerald Ford. We just heard him say he was and remains the only person in the U.S. to have served both as vice president and president without having been elected to either. Why didn't he win re-election?
Yeah, it was an unusual moment. He took over from President Nixon when he resigned, and he himself had been appointed after another scandal involving Nixon's first vice president. It was a close election. In the end, I think Ford was weighed down by the legacy of Watergate. He couldn't separate himself. And by pardoning Richard Nixon, he became part of the story. And second, the economy was in a lot of trouble in the 1970s. And as his successor would discover, it was hard to win. It was a close election, but not enough to pull it off.
What did Carter and Ford have in common, these back-to-back one-term presidents?
Both of them, in some ways, they were clearly wrestling with the economy of the 1970s, an economy that they couldn't dig themselves out of or the country out of. But they were also both dealing with the legacy of both Vietnam and Watergate and this culture of distrust that had emerged in the country about politics, about presidents. Ford tried to resolve this by pardoning Nixon, and that didn't work. It had the opposite effect. Carter tried to do it by being a president who wasn't president, meaning dropping some of the formality of the presidency, not being beholden to interest groups, and taking chances on policies that weren't popular, like energy conservation, but were needed. In the end, it wasn't enough, but I think they were both wrestling with some common issues.
I heard you mention the financial state of the country, and I just went right to James Carville. It's the economy, stupid. In 1992, when he was, you know, consulting for Bill Clinton, Clinton made a one-termer out of George Herbert Walker Bush. It seems like a few presidents have struggled with the economy. How impactful are those kitchen table issues, like how much gas costs, versus the cultural issues when it comes to incumbents?
I mean, look, they all blend together, and it's hard to separate how people are evaluating a leader because all of these issues are in their mind. Even Carter in 1980 was dealing not with a cultural issue, but the Iran hostage crisis, which was important in terms of evaluating him. But 92 is instructive. Look, President George H.W. Bush seemed at the top of his game in 1991. The polls were through the roof after Operation Desert Storm was pretty successful and pretty quick. And there were many people speculating who's going to beat him. Many Republicans decided they didn't even want to run, and many Democrats didn't. But in the end, Clinton figured a path forward. And that economic angle, as there was a recession, was more powerful than anything else. So I don't think it's the only issue. I think in upcoming elections, we're going to have cultural issues will matter. But certainly, do people have enough to feed their family? Do they have enough to pay the rent? Do they feel secure that 3 to 4 months from now they'll have a job? If those answers are no, as it was for many people in 92, an incumbent's going to be in trouble.
Has there ever been, though, I'm curious, in your knowledge, a cultural issue that did move the needle, something that was going on culturally within the country that really led to someone being a one-termer?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, in 1968, Lyndon Johnson decides he's not going to run again. The big issue is Vietnam, so it's a foreign policy issue. But in 68, the country was torn up over all sorts of social and cultural issues, including race relations, which was front and center, including issues of cultural identity for younger people and kind of what was traditional and what was acceptable. All those issues were swirling through the electorate. When Richard Nixon is talking about a silent majority and talking about the people who have no voice, part of it is people who didn't agree with the left on Vietnam and how they were criticizing Vietnam. But part of it was everything else. It was, where were you on racial and civil rights issues? Where were you on the counterculture? So that's an example where those issues really rose, I think, to the top of the political debate.
My guest is Julian Zelizer, history professor at Princeton University and author. You often hear him on Here and Now as well. In 2011, you wrote an op-ed in the Times that said, one-term presidents usually leave office with their parties divided, the economy in crisis, wars unresolved, approval ratings in the tank, and a sullen public rejecting him. I'm wondering about the sullen public part of that. How does the public's, for lack of a better term, feeling versus the reality about an incumbent matter?
Feeling matters a lot. Often I looked in that article, one-term presidents have done a lot while they're in office. Many have pretty significant legislative achievements. Many have had moments of high favorability, or they've done things that really left a legacy. But people don't see them that way at the moment. They see the problems, they see the flaws. And usually when we have one-term presidents, that's where the country is in terms of evaluating leadership. And even the presidents who voluntarily said, I'm not going to run again, such as Lyndon Johnson or Harry Truman, that doesn't help the situation. So there is a disconnect often between the record and the achievement and how people see the president. But how people see the president, that's really going to be the key in terms of how they vote on Election Day.
And this brings me to Donald Trump currently. You've written about how hard Donald Trump works to control his image and how history will remember him. You've edited a recent book called The Presidency of Donald J. Trump, A First Historical Assessment. You know, tactically speaking, he's, you know, we've just heard that he's taken the fifth in these questioning from Letitia James, the New York AG. Is he smart to control his image?
Well, he's done something that we really haven't seen from the others that we've discussed, in terms of he's not accepting at some level that he is a one-term president. He never did. So from the moment the defeat was clear, he has claimed there wasn't a defeat. And what's been interesting is he's been able to sell this idea to a lot of the public, certainly Republicans who believe there was something wrong with that election decision. And so he has continued to have that posture. He's continued to fight against the establishment, as he describes it, and somehow position himself as a one-term president who actually didn't lose, and a former president who isn't part of the political establishment somehow, even though he's the most powerful person in the world. So if you're just talking about strategy, there is a logic, I think, to what he's done. And it depends on a big media ecosystem to support what he's saying, but he has that at his disposal right now.
In an email exchange we had, you described Trump as intriguing, and you just described why, but you also described, you said Carter was intriguing to you. How so?
Carter is an example, I think, and historians are looking back more and more, of a president who did a lot in 4 years. And he was a president who didn't always consider the political implications of what he was doing. He would take an issue, again, like energy conservation, which at the time didn't really have broad support, and he'd move forward on it despite the political fallout that he faced. Or even with the Iran hostage crisis in 1980, he was privately working very hard on resolving the issue, and does resolve it before he loses, but the public doesn't see this. So he is a quintessential example of a president whose accomplishments were far greater than his political success. And And that's why he's an interesting case study to debate.
In an opinion piece for CNN, you drew some similarities between Jimmy Carter, who we just discussed, and Joe Biden. What is similar about them when we're talking about this topic, and what is something that is distinctly different?
Well, I think, look, both in different ways, we're trying to restore the confidence that Americans had in a political system that seemed fundamentally broken. Both operated in the shadow of presidencies that were filled with scandal and turmoil, and in different ways. Biden, much more an insider, longtime Washington person. Carter, pretty much a newbie to the Washington circles in 1977. Both made efforts to restore normalcy, to kind of bring back a sense that government could work. The big difference is Biden is a creature of Washington. He has spent his entire career there. He understands and loves the legislative process. In a way, Carter never did. He didn't totally get that. He really was an outsider. And so I think that's a distinction. And it might explain a little bit of the difference in terms of the legislative record that Biden's able to amass, in contrast to Carter, where those weren't quite as voluminous.
If, for whatever reason, Joe Biden does not run for president, how does history treat our one-term presidents?
Well, initially not well. And I think all one-term presidents certainly go through a period where they are seen as failures. I mean, it is literally the definition for many of what a one-term president is, someone who couldn't win two terms. Even if they step down, the stepping down is seen as an act of sacrifice when there's no political path forward, such as Lyndon Johnson in 1968. But over time, it does change. Some have struggled. I mean, Herbert Hoover, who comes before Franklin Roosevelt, never has really recovered from how people saw him, although it's changed, but he's still seen as someone who was not successful. But others, like Carter or George H.W. Bush, over time, people start to appreciate more of what they were able to do. And ironically, they even appreciate the fact that they were presidents, both of those, in fact, who were willing to sacrifice political capital to do what they thought was right for the country. And so over time, you can be a successful one-term president in terms of your legacy.
I'm going to put a little asterisk next to this and ask you to give us a little bit of a history lesson. Can you provide a bit of historical context for us all as we're reading the news about one-term president Donald Trump and the raid on Mar-a-Lago and the questioning today with the Attorney General where he took the Fifth? Just something you'd like us all to remember and think about the history of this country and think about the history of the presidency that would be useful as we're all trying to make sense of this news.
Yeah, I think it's fair if you take all of the stories that have surrounded the former president, including the January 6th committee hearings, to understand at some level the magnitude of the charges that are out there about what he did. We have not really had a former president going through so many high-level issues like this. Nixon would have been the closest, but he was pardoned, so it didn't move forward. And I think as people evaluate, should there be a second Trump term, assuming that he does run, this period in between is filled with charges that do make Watergate look kind of small in many ways. We don't know the FBI search and exactly what that is, so I don't want to kind of comment too much until we know. But we know enough. The kind of effort to overturn the election and the continued effort to do so, to deny the legitimacy of the election with him at the center. We're talking about one of the highest level scandals that we have seen, certainly in post-presidential history.
Julian Zelizar is a history professor at Princeton University and, of course, an author. Thank you so much for making time. I appreciate you. I tracked you down because I was interested in this, and I really appreciate you responding.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music field trip to America's Jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.